came down to see what the fuss was all about. The room became very still while he surveyed the scene. Then he pronounced, with affected solemnity, "Captain Mary, when the engagement is over, you will send in an official report," whereupon the room exploded in laughter so loud that it was heard far out into the street. Jackson's good mood and high spirits were at least partly the result of his excellent health. Since June 1861, 2 months into the war, all of those old ailments, the uveitis, the stomach troubles, the nagging sinus infections and aches, and various organ complaints, had mysteriously vanished. This had happened, in Jackson's words, since leaving home. Thus, one of Jackson's oldest, strongest, and most visible obsessions had vanished altogether, and would not reappear during his life in the war. It is hard from a distance of 153 years to fully make sense of this. Jackson had, as we know, some very real ailments. The pain in his eyes and the floaters he saw before him were not figments of his imagination, nor was his burning dyspepsia. But the sudden and complete absence of these afflictions suggests, at the very least, that his state of mind had something to do with them. A man who was, at the very core of his existence, a warrior, had been forced throughout his life into other pursuits and occupations. Even in his army years, he spent only a few weeks in actual combat. Now, finally, it seemed that he was fulfilling some old destiny, and he felt, for one of the few times in his adult life, perfectly fine. There was something else, too, that made him happy. In February, Anna became pregnant. Nathaniel Prentice Banks was a splendid-looking man. Everyone said so. Trim, compact, and athletic, with luxuriant, artfully tousled brown hair and a splendid military-style mustache, in his sharply tailored uniform, yellow dress gloves, and gleaming saber, he looked the very model of the Civil War general. He looked, indeed, in body type and facial structure, a good deal like his immediate superior, George McClellan. And he had something of McClellan's erect, confident, dignified, patrician bearing. Banks had what a contemporary called a genius for being looked at. This was curious because there was absolutely nothing of the aristocrat in him. He had grown up in the working-class neighborhoods of Waltham, Massachusetts, the son of the cotton mill foreman, had himself gone to work in the mill at age 14 for $2 a week, and had married a Waltham factory girl. But he was bright, engaging, and intensely ambitious. He taught himself law, was admitted to the bar at 23, and by sheer force of will dragged himself up and out of the drudgery and dead-end world of the textile mills. He started out as a bobbin boy, replacing full bobbins of thread with empty ones. He acquired the nickname Bobbin Boy Banks, which he carried for the rest of his life. His entry into politics in 1830 began a stunning rise to power and influence. He was elected to the U.S. Congress in 1853 and became Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in 1856. As a nationally prominent anti-slavery Republican, he played a key role in getting John Fremont that party's nomination for president in 1856. He was elected governor of Massachusetts in 1858 and ran for the 1860 Republican presidential nomination against Lincoln, whom he later supported and who seriously considered him for a cabinet post. Just prior to the war, Banks had succeeded George McClellan as director of the Illinois Central Railroad, whose principal attorney, before his 1860 election to the presidency, had been Abraham Lincoln. With his sparkling connections and his booming oratorical voice, Nathaniel Banks was a potent force in the North, and Lincoln owed him many political debts. It was partly for that reason that he appointed Banks, with no military experience, one of the first Union major generals of the war, an exalted rank that left many West Pointers and regular Army men over whom he had been promoted, seething with anger and jealousy. He was the fourth-ranking general in the Union, and its most prominent political general. And now it had fallen to him to make the first Union thrust into Virginia. This was no idle task. The very idea of probing into the Confederacy itself was frightening. The terrain was unknown, exotic. Most of it was unmapped or inaccurately mapped. There were hostile civilians, ubiquitous spies, constant threats to supply lines, who knows what rebel armies or guerrilla units lurking behind every mountain, and the ultimate horror of being encircled or cut off in enemy territory. But even with so much uncertainty, it must be said that Banks, in the first week of March, camped in the Virginia towns of Charlestown and Martinsburg, had almost everything going for him. That began with nearly perfect intelligence of his enemy's strength, position, and defensive works. He knew with rare precision exactly how many regiments Jackson had, and even the names of his regimental commanders. He knew Jackson's overall strength and the strength of the average company, 30, well down from the 100 it should have been. He knew where trenches had been dug and where earthworks had been built. He knew, from a deserter from the 2nd Virginia Regiment, that many of Jackson's men were carrying smoothbore muskets with percussion caps. His staff officer, David Hunter Strother, a Northern Virginian who before the war had written humorous travelogues for Harper's Monthly under the pseudonym Port Crayon, knew the countryside intimately. Knowing all this, Banks also knew with nearly absolute certainty just what a crushing advantage he held. And in early March, he began to exercise it. Since there was an outside chance that Jackson might be reinforced by Johnston in Manassas, Banks moved slowly but quite deliberately. On March 7, advanced units of his army, conducting a reconnaissance in force, moved to within 4 miles of Winchester. There his cavalry encountered Jackson's cavalry chief, Turner Ashby, and his own mounted troops in a wood. A sharp skirmish followed, which Union troops won handily. This confirmed what Banks and his commanders had heard elsewhere, that the feeble rebel force was no match for them. They had heard, moreover, that Jackson's army was about to evacuate Winchester. By March 10, Banks had moved closer, spreading his army in a 90-degree arc north of the town, and moving to control 4 roads leading into Winchester from the north and east. Jackson, meanwhile, was indeed moving out. He had no choice. His supply wagons, as well as his artillery, were either already in Strasburg or on the road. On March 11, his men followed. He had sent Anna away the first week in March. Winchester residents, about to be abandoned to the clutches of an invading army and unaware of the hard logic that made it necessary, were dumbfounded. It did not seem possible that Jackson would retreat. As one of them, a Mrs. Cornelia MacDonald, wrote, she spent the night in violent fits of weeping at the thought of being left, and what might happen to that army before we should see it again. By the evening of March 11, much of Jackson's army was either on the road or camped 4 miles south, near the hamlet of Kernstown. But Jackson, as it turned out, had never had any intention of abandoning Winchester without a fight. It was a characteristic of him that he had told neither his senior officers nor his quartermaster about this. In the alarmingly transparent world of border state Virginia, where Nathaniel Banks could learn everything about Stonewall Jackson and his army, down to gossip and small details, it was perhaps not surprising that Jackson was learning to value secrecy. But, as with the Romney expedition, he would pay a price for it. On the evening of March 11, Jackson convened a council of war, where he astonished his officers by proposing a daring and unconventional night attack on a federal position north of Winchester. He had always intended this, he said. His troops, now camped 4 miles south of town, would simply turn around, march to the north side of town, and attack. Jackson was under no illusion that he could win a pitched battle with a 6 or 7 to 1 disadvantage. But he could strike the Federals anyway, perhaps make them think that he was stronger than he was, perhaps help cover his retreat. It is noteworthy that Jackson's proposal came as other Confederate armies in Virginia were falling back. Johnston, anticipating a federal offensive in the spring, had retired from Manassas on March 8 headed for camps below the Rappahannock. D.H. Hill at Leesburg in northern Virginia had also moved south. Jackson, moreover, had not been ordered to attack anyone. The deeply and characteristically hedged orders he had received from Johnston instructed him only to endeavor to employ the invaders of the valley, but without exposing himself to the danger of defeat by keeping so near the enemy as to prevent him from making any considerable detachment to reinforce McClellan, but not so near that he might be compelled to fight. In other words, retreat, but do it as slowly as you can. Jackson's officers unanimously rejected his proposal. He explained it in earnest once again, in more detail, and they rejected it again, for several reasons. First, the supply wagons that Jackson thought were 3 miles south of town were actually 7 miles away. Second, the men themselves were still strung out on the road for miles. A 10-mile forced march at night with tired men was simply not possible, he was told. He reluctantly gave the order to evacuate the town. By morning, the last of the Confederate army was moving out, as the townspeople watched, in sullen disbelief. The war would be very hard on them. Their marvelous but unfortunately situated town would be the scene of 3 major battles and 12 skirmishes. It would change hands 72 times during the war, and 13 times in a single day. It would eventually be depopulated and, for all practical purposes, destroyed. Jackson, having put his idea to a vote and having accepted defeat, was bitterly disappointed. As dawn lit up the skies over the smoky Blue Ridge Mountains, he and his medical officer, Hunter McGuire, rode to a promontory overlooking the town of Winchester and watched the long line of men snake southward. Both were overwhelmed by emotion, McGuire with sadness because he was leaving his hometown, Jackson with anger because he had lost an opportunity. "I was utterly overcome by the fact that I was leaving all that I held dear on earth," said McGuire later, "but my emotion was arrested by one look at Jackson. His face was fairly blazing with the fire that was burning in him, and I felt awed before him. Presently he cried out with a manner almost savage, 'That is the last council of war I will ever hold.' And it was, his first and last." Jackson could not know that on that same day, 80 miles to the east, events were taking place that would change both the course of the war and his own destiny. Lincoln, frustrated with McClellan's refusal to advance in spite of considerable prodding, relieved McClellan of overall command of Union armies. While he was left in charge of the Army of the Potomac, Lincoln and Stanton would now assume authority over the other parts of that army. This included the newly constituted 5th Corps under Nathaniel Banks, who had previously reported directly to McClellan. McClellan, meanwhile, had radically shifted his plan of attack. In response to an order from Lincoln, Special War Order No. 1, that he move against Manassas on or before February 22, which he refused to obey, he came up with a plan to move his huge army by boat to the mouth of the Rappahannock, about 80 miles southeast of Manassas. They would thus land behind Johnston and move against Richmond. Unfortunately, Johnston's retreat to the Rappahannock had ruined that scheme. It had also done something far worse. It had exposed McClellan's prodigiously inaccurate estimates of Confederate troop strength. McClellan had claimed, based on intelligence from Pinkerton, that he was facing 100,000 rebel troops. Newspaper correspondents visiting abandoned camps found evidence of no more than 45,000. Not only that, but many of the big cannons supposedly aimed at Little Mac's army turned out to be Quaker guns, logs painted black and made to look like weapons. The news was shocking, and the press made much of it. "Utterly dispirited, ashamed, and humiliated," wrote Bayard Taylor of the New York Tribune, "I return from this visit to the rebel stronghold. For 7 months we have waited, organized a powerful army, until its drill and equipment should be so complete that we might safely advance against the Gibraltar of rebellion. And now we see that our enemies, like the Chinese, have frightened us by the sound of gongs and the wearing of devil masks. Under intense pressure, Secretary of State William Seward, among others, was ranting about McClellan's imbecility. McClellan, on March 13, came up with a new plan. It would still involve putting 120,000 men on boats, but this time he would take them clear to Fortress Monroe at the end of the York James Peninsula. They would then march 100 miles up the peninsula and attack Richmond. Lincoln, who was convinced that attacking armies and not places was the way to win, did not like the idea. He wrote McClellan in scolding tones that his plan would amount to only shifting and not surmounting a difficulty, that we would find the same enemy and the same or equal entrenchments at either place. The country will not fail to note, is now noting, that the present hesitation to move on the entrenched enemy is but the story of Manassas repeated. You must act. McClellan nonetheless would have his way. It is worth remembering this moment in the middle of part of the chilly, rainy month of March, 1862, in the second year of the war. Joe Johnston and D.H. Hill are falling back to the Rappahannock. Confederate armies are being routed in the west. Confederate coastal defenses in North Carolina are crumbling. Jackson is on the run in the Shenandoah Valley. The once buoyant optimism of the South is giving way to fear and hopelessness. Jackson's opponent, Nathaniel Banks, holds such a crushing numerical advantage that he is less worried about Jackson's pathetic, slapdash army than about missing the real action east of the Blue Ridge. To Banks and his bosses in Washington, Jackson is merely an insignificant buzzing on the periphery of the real war, something to be swatted away. They would soon have occasion to change their minds. Chapter 20. The Realm of the Possible. Late on the chilly, rain-lashed afternoon of March 21, 1862, an elderly former militia officer named Jonah Tavener was traveling on horseback from his home in Loudoun County, Virginia, to the Shenandoah Valley. He had just come through Snicker's Gap, one of the main passes through the Blue Ridge Mountains, when he saw something that in that month and year of the war was still extraordinary. A large body of blue-clad troops, 2,000 to 3,000 of them, winding their way eastward. Eastward. Tavener may have been too old for the army, but he was not too old to understand an important enemy troop movement when he saw it. Undetected by Union scouts, he swung south of the marching column, where he soon encountered Confederate riders under the command of Colonel Turner Ashby, who happened to be an old acquaintance. He was taken to Ashby, to whom he told his story. Ashby immediately grasped its importance. He dispatched Tavener, along with a special courier, to Jackson himself, where his story detonated like an 18-pound percussion shell. The news changed everything. It altered Jackson's strategy and set in motion events that changed the war in the Shenandoah Valley and the war in Virginia. It even changed the fate of the Union troops Tavener had seen. Though he did not understand it at the time, Tavener had spotted a piece of McClellan's master plan to destroy the Confederacy, a plan as yet unknown to the brain trust in the Confederate War Department in Richmond. Tavener's little discovery had another effect, too. It prompted the opening move in what would become known to history as Stonewall Jackson's Valley Campaign. To understand what Tavener saw, we have to back up 5 days, to a somewhat simpler moment when it seemed that fortune was smiling on the Union and all its works, and there was no possibility that a minor irritant like Thomas J. Jackson could ever cause any real trouble in Virginia. McClellan was preparing for his unprecedented gambit, the movement of his army from Washington to the York James Peninsula. He was also bound by previous agreement with President Lincoln to leave enough men to keep Washington, D.C. entirely secure. Fearful, as usual, that the enemy had more soldiers than he did, McClellan was scrambling to bring in every able-bodied man he could find. Thus, on March 16, 4 days after Jackson's retreat, McClellan sent an order to Major General Nathaniel Banks in Winchester, summoning his two divisions to the Washington area, where their presence would free up soldiers for the great expedition. "Post your command in the vicinity of Manassas," he told Banks. "Entrench yourself strongly and throw cavalry pickets well out to the front." He also instructed Banks to leave something like 2 regiments of cavalry to occupy Winchester and thoroughly scour the country south of the railway and up the Shenandoah Valley. For once, Little Mac was not exaggerating Confederate troop strength. That was because it was manifestly against his self-interest to do so. It would have deprived him of men he desperately needed. The valley could be dealt with briefly and dismissively. It was a strategic afterthought, a sideshow. Thus, Banks began preparations for departure. He sent a division, more than 9,000 soldiers, under the command of Brigadier General James Shields, to chase Jackson. Shields was to destroy him if possible, but in any case, to make sure he was indeed far away from Winchester when the Federal troops marched out. Shields was one of the more arresting personalities of the early war. Like his immediate superior, Nathaniel Banks, he was wealthy, politically powerful, and entirely self-made. Born and raised in Ireland, he sailed for America at age 16, but was shipwrecked off the coast of Scotland. He stayed in that country working as a tutor to a wealthy family. 4 years later, he finally made it to New York, where he discovered that a wealthy uncle, who had promised to help him, had died. He briefly went to sea with a merchantman and eventually fetched up in Illinois, where he studied law and was admitted to the bar in 1832. He was elected to the Illinois legislature as a Democrat in 1836, thus beginning a rapid political ascent that was marred only by a smear campaign conducted against him by his fellow Illinois politician, Abraham Lincoln. The campaign led Shields to challenge Lincoln to a duel. Lincoln apologized, and the two men somehow ended up friends. Shields became a justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, commissioner of the General Land Office in Washington, and a U.S. senator from Illinois. He was a brigadier general in the Mexican-American War, where he was wounded twice, and led the decisive charge in the Battle of Churubusco. He became wealthy in various businesses that included a silver mine in Mexico. Shields was slender, 5 feet 8 inches tall, and immaculately dressed. He was urbane, sophisticated, confident, charming, funny, and courtly. He was also, in the words of one of his artillery officers, vainglorious to the last degree. This unfortunate latter trait would destroy his Civil War career. His vanity must have been enormously flattered by his troops' triumphant march up the Valley Pike, strutting like an army of occupation and opposed only by Turner Ashby's small cavalry unit that served as Jackson's rear guard. Shields was now deep into the mysterious, lethal, alien world of the Confederacy. Redbuds were in early bloom. The sullen, hostile citizenry stared balefully at the Union soldiers as they passed. One of his soldiers thought uncharitably that some of them had a cowed and stupid look. Though Ashby's cavaliers could not match Shields' numbers or his firepower, they could make trouble. And that is what they did, burning bridges, sniping at pickets, and lobbing shells from their 3-gun horse artillery. As equestrians, the Union cavalry was simply no match for them. Indeed, they were awestruck by the seemingly deer-like ability of Ashby's troopers to jump fences and cross rough terrain at high speed, and generally ride circles around them. At one point, Shields concocted a plan to circle and entrap the Southern cavalry, which failed laughably. A gull would stand as good a chance to catch a fox as our force to catch Ashby, wrote one of Shields' staff. Thus did Ashby's gallant 700 harass and annoy Shields as he drove south in the shadow of the hulking Massanutten Mountains. They certainly slowed him down. but they changed no Union minds. Shields' division entered the valley town of Strasburg unopposed, then pursued Ashby another 5 miles south. At that point, Ashby's guns opened again, but at such a ridiculous distance, according to one Union officer, that the Irish general concluded that his work was done. Jackson, by Shields' reckoning, was now at least 40 miles south of Winchester. He was no longer a threat. Shields' infantry turned and marched back to Strasburg. The next day, March 20, they returned to Winchester, a hard march in wind, rain, and bone-chilling cold. They were in a hurry. The war was going to be over soon, the action was all going to be to the east, and no one, not least Banks and Shields, wanted to miss it. Ashby, trailing Shields northward through the valley, soon concluded that the Union general had given up his pursuit. That was the first stunning piece of news Ashby gave Jackson on March 21. Until the moment he heard it, Jackson had been facing both the destruction of his army and the loss of the valley. Ashby's scouts and spies had reported that Shields would likely pursue him to Stanton, a large, prosperous town that was the Southern Valley's counterpart to Winchester in the north. Stanton was Jackson's supply base. It was also a strategic gem. Whoever held it held the Upper Valley, and the Upper Valley was the back door to Richmond. If Union troops could move unobstructed east through Rockfish Gap in the Blue Ridge and aboard the Virginia Central Railroad, they could virtually guarantee the city's fall. Jackson, outnumbered 3-1, could either fight it out where he stood, in the vicinity of Mount Jackson, or fight it out farther south. Either way, the outlook, in the absence of reinforcements, was grim if not hopeless. Jackson, with little real choice, had been planning to turn and fight even before he heard Ashby's news, even though there was almost no way he could have won. The second piece of news, even more electrifying to Jackson, came in the person of Jonah Tavner. Shields' abandonment of his pursuit had suggested to Jackson that Banks was leaving the valley to reinforce McClellan. Tavener's story offered striking confirmation. It also suggested a course of action. 2 days before, on March 19, Jackson had received a letter from Joe Johnston, now camped safely behind the Rappahannock, 50 miles south of Washington. Johnston had a very specific agenda. He wanted Jackson to do everything he could to keep Banks from reinforcing the Union Army at Richmond. "It is important to keep that army in the valley," he wrote, "and that it should not reinforce McClellan. Do try to prevent it by getting and keeping as near as prudence will permit." This was easy enough for Johnston to say. He was not alone in the valley facing a much larger Union force. Jackson was clearly not supposed to give battle. At that moment, no one in Richmond was in the mood for another humiliating Confederate defeat. In Johnston's fantasy world, Jackson would be able to dance so tantalizingly near that the Federals would have no choice but to keep Banks's divisions in the valley. But in fact, Johnston's message was exactly what Jackson wanted to hear. He wasted no time and consulted no one. He would never again repeat the fiasco of his Winchester Council of War. Armed with both Ashby's and Tavener's intelligence, he put his army on the road the next morning, March 22, heading straight back up the Valley Pike for Winchester. That day he conducted the first of many forced marches in the valley. 23 miles through mud and rain, 27 miles for the rearmost units, at a pace that caused scores of men to drop from exhaustion and wagons and supplies to fall miles behind the infantry. Men were hungry, footsore and miserable, but they covered a large amount of ground quickly. They would soon be famous for it and earn another nickname for themselves, Jackson's Foot Cavalry. Jackson's operating principles in combat were speed and deception. March 22, 1862, saw the first full-scale exercise of the former. Fast or not, though, it was an astoundingly risky move. The march placed Jackson 95 miles from his supply base, in a countryside abounding with federal soldiers who were eager to destroy him. There were at least 10,000 Union troops at Winchester, perhaps far more. At that point, Jackson had no way of knowing. Taverner had seen only a single brigade heading east, but from Jackson's point of view, his mission was clear. Keep Banks in the valley. He was accomplishing that the only way he knew. In his mind, too, was his beloved Winchester, whose residence he had abandoned without a fight 11 days before. While Jackson was pushing his men furiously north, Ashby, well in advance, had plans of his own. At 2 p.m., he and a small force of riders hit Shields' supply train about 4 miles south of Winchester, near the tiny hamlet of Kernstown, which consisted of a handful of businesses, butcher, wheelwright, blacksmith, cooperage and tavern, and a stone church. He had unloaded enough shell and canister to get their attention and nearly captured part of the supply train, when Shields summoned cavalry, artillery, and infantry and counterattacked. Ashby, greatly outnumbered, fell back 6 miles to Newtown. Though he had done little damage to men or materiel, one of his shell fragments had managed to strike Brigadier General Shields in the chest and shoulder. He fainted several times and was carried from the field. Turner Ashby embodied the immense cavalry advantages the South held early in the war. There were a number of reasons for this. The South had more people who used the horse as an integral part of their lives, and the landed Southern gentry was full of accomplished riders. Northerners, meanwhile, were more likely to see horses as beasts of burden. Confederate cavalries also had superior animals, mainly because of the Southern fondness for racing, and because Southern cavalrymen supplied their own mounts. Most Southern towns had their own horse tracks. In the North, slow-moving draft horses were the preferred breeds. Cavalry in the Civil War was rarely used to charge infantry. More often it functioned as the army's eyes, tracking enemy movements, screening their own army's movements, using their high mobility to strike enemy communications and supply lines. To be effective required serious expertise, which necessitated far more training than the infantry received. Even the greenest infantry could be more or less shoved into battle. Not so cavalrymen. In the North, it was thought that it took fully 2 years to produce a seasoned trooper. The dark-eyed, dark-skinned, heavily bearded 33-year-old Ashby was, by all accounts, as brilliant a pure rider as anyone in Virginia had ever seen. In the remaining 2 months of his life, his dashing, reckless, romantic bravery, riding in the service of Stonewall Jackson, would captivate the South. He came, in fact, to represent for many Southerners everything that was noble and superior about the Southern cause. In a world where Northerners tended to see shades of Simon Legree, he was said to be honorable, charitable, Christian, gentle except when in a fight, of pure character, and of course, he could and did ride with reckless abandon through the ranks of his Yankee counterparts. "Riding his black stallion, he looked like a knight of the olden time," wrote Henry Kidd Douglas, a member of Jackson's staff. "Galloping over the field on his favorite war horse, his white one, eager, watchful, he was fascinating, inspiring. Altogether, he was the most picturesque horseman ever seen in the Shenandoah Valley." His background was less spectacular. He grew up on a modest family farm in Fauquier County that suffered considerable economic hardship. He never attended college, and instead went into mercantile business, operating out of a shop near a railroad depot, at which he was not very successful. Nor was he exactly the beau ideal he seemed in articles such as the one in Southern Illustrated News that pictured him on a white charger and wearing a long coat and plumed hat, the very model of equestrian gallantry. He was in fact a fierce, driven, border state partisan who specialized in a brutal and highly irregular form of warfare, far from the eye of the public or the press. One example: In October 1861, after a fight with Union cavalry, Ashby and his troopers stripped four of the Union dead naked and spread one out in the form of the crucifixion, with holes cut through his palms. It is hard to see the chivalry in such an act, which horrified Union soldiers. In 1861, too, he had avenged the wounding of some of his men in a skirmish by killing what he estimated in a letter to his sister was 20 or 30 of them. Ashby was driven partly, if not wholly, by vengeance. In June 1861, he and his brother Richard had served in the 7th Virginia Cavalry, guarding the border counties of the lower, northernmost Shenandoah Valley, and hunting down Unionists. In one fight, Richard received a saber blow that took off part of his head and knocked him from his saddle. While he writhed on the ground, his attacker ran his sword through Richard's abdomen, stole his spurs and horse, and rode off. Turner later found his brother, blood bubbling from his mouth, begging for water. He suffered for a week, then died. "From that hour, Turner Ashby was a changed man," wrote fellow Virginian Dabney Maury. "A stern sorrow, his controlling motive. A deep purpose of vengeance possessed him. All his buoyancy and bright hopes of fame gave place to grief." There is no doubt that Turner Ashby was a brilliant, dashing cavalier. He was almost unbelievably brave. He was also a stone-cold killer. In spite of Ashby's strenuous efforts with his little force of 290 horsemen on the afternoon of March 22, neither Banks nor his division commander Shields had taken his presence seriously. They were convinced that Jackson was still 40 or more miles away, and that Ashby, for whatever reason, was simply choosing to pester them, to no particular end. Jackson, meanwhile, rolling north at full speed, was now a half-day's march away from Winchester, and planning a full-scale assault. He, too, was very much in the dark about his enemy, but in a far more dangerous way. That evening, Ashby reported to Jackson that only four Union regiments and one or two batteries remained in Winchester, a force so small that even Jackson's little army outnumbered it. But Ashby's normally reliable intelligence was dead wrong. Only one Union division had left the valley. Jonah Tavner had seen the first third of it on the afternoon of March 21. The other two brigades, under Brigadier General Alpheus Williams, had followed the next morning. But that left a full division under Shields, which outnumbered Jackson at least 2-1. Jackson was marching squarely and unknowingly into what amounted to a trap. It was indeed such an apparently perfect, elegant trap that James Shields would later falsely claim credit for having deliberately designed it to draw Jackson in. Chapter 21. A Jagged Line of Blood. Generals Banks, Shields, and just about everyone else in command in the Union Army in Winchester awoke on the overcast early morning of Sunday, March 23, with the same thought: that Turner Ashby, whatever odd mischief he had been up to the day before, was long gone. Two full Union divisions were going to march east across the mighty Blue Ridge Mountains to join McClellan in his grand enterprise, and there was nothing to stop them. The war was going to be won, and soon, and they were going to be part of the army that would march triumphantly into Richmond before the summer's heats. And so it caused considerable surprise and consternation when a federal reconnaissance patrol, sometime around 9 a.m., ran smack into Ashby's cavalry and horse artillery. He hadn't gone anywhere. Not only that, he had somehow been reinforced with four infantry regiments, and apparently intended not merely to harass, but also to move aggressively forward up the eastern side of the Valley Turnpike. Ashby, believing his own faulty intelligence, and as always recklessly brave, was determined to sweep straight into Winchester and retake the town before Jackson arrived. It was unfortunate for him that while Banks and Shields, stationed in a house 3 miles north in Winchester, persisted in believing that this small rebel force posed no threat, the wounded Shields' battlefield replacement, Colonel Nathan Kimball, very definitely did not. Kimball, a smart, sensible Indiana doctor and Mexican-American War veteran, who would go on to a distinguished war career as a Union general, wasted no time in countering Ashby's attack. He threw troops forward and brought reinforcements up. Soon he had 3,000 men on the field facing Ashby's 450 north of the small village of Kernstown and east of the Valley Pike. Kimball was not aware that Ashby's force was so small. Ashby was repulsed just after 9 a.m. and then again at about 10 a.m. By 10:30 he had a pretty clear idea of what he was up against, and it was emphatically not the skeleton force he had told Jackson about, though he would compound his earlier mistake by mysteriously failing to tell Jackson of this potentially shattering development. Mini-balls from the Federal sharpshooters zipped through his ranks with their peculiar, sibilant hiss, while the weirdly accurate rifled Parrott guns of the Federal artillery began to find their range. One of Ashby's artillerists recalled what it was like to watch, for the first time, incoming artillery. "I saw it flying in its graceful curve through the air, coming directly toward the spot where I was standing. I watched it until it struck the ground about 15 feet in front of me. I was so interested in the skyball, in its harmless appearance, and surprised that a shell could be so plainly seen during its flight that I forgot for a moment that danger lurked in the black speck that was descending to earth before me, like a schoolboy's innocent plaything. It proved to have been a percussion shell, and when it struck the ground it exploded and scattered itself in every direction around me." Nathan Kimball, meanwhile, believing that he was still not seeing the rebels' full strength, and ignoring orders from his convalescent commander to attack, had made a wonderful discovery. Just north of Kernstown and west of the Valley Pike was an elevated promontory known as Pritchard's Hill, the sort of defensive position Army commanders dream about. "The position commanded the plain or valley and village in front," he later wrote. "No better position could be found to cover the approaches to Winchester with the forces I had." He proceeded to load the top of the hill with men and cannons until the place fairly bristled with firepower. By early afternoon, Pritchard's Hill held 16 guns, 300 artillerists, and 6 full regiments, the better part of 3,500 men. Banks and Shields continued to be certain, in spite of Ashby's peculiar behavior, that Jackson could not possibly be crazy or brave enough to, as Shields later put it, hazard himself so far away from his main support. To march on Winchester with such a small force would be suicidal, and it did not take a genius to see that. So secure was the Union command in this conviction that Banks left that afternoon by train for Harper's Ferry, en route to his new assignment in Manassas. He was quite pleased with it. He was trading an obscure sideshow for the main event. Shields, supremely confident and full of his usual bravado, told his subordinate Colonel Sullivan, in Sullivan's words, that there was no danger of Jackson's fighting again, that he knew him, and Jackson was afraid of him. If that was true, Jackson had an odd way of showing it. At 7 a.m. he had put his men on the road again, 3 brigades and 5 batteries of 24 cannons. All told, he had 3,500 infantry and artillerymen. "With the blessing of an ever-kind providence," he wrote General Johnston before leaving, "I hope to be in the vicinity of Winchester this evening." Out on the arrow-straight, macadamized Valley Pike, he drove his men brutally hard. 50 minutes of march, 10 minutes of rest, sometimes less. After the grueling march of the day before, many fell out of the ranks. The phenomenon was known as straggling. It was the bane of Civil War armies, and it could embrace everything from nearly outright desertion to the inability of a soldier with a toe infection to keep up with the rest of his company. A man with severe diarrhea, for example, and there were many, would be forced to leave his marching column repeatedly. He would fall behind. Over many miles, he would fall very far behind, and would be literally hours behind his regiment, unattached and uncommanded. Some men straggled to pick blueberries or to drink from streams. Some were drunk or suffering from hangovers. Many straggled because they did not want to fight. The practice was often so widespread that it was virtually impossible for commanders to court-martial all offenders, even if they wanted to. Thus, the disciplining of stragglers, arrest, court-martial, fines, confinement, and sometimes even the threat of the firing squad, was inconsistent at best, and depended on the mood of the commanding general. It was an enormous problem for both sides throughout the Civil War, and no commander ever solved it. Jackson, who drove his men harder and faster than any other commander in the war, inevitably faced the problem. On this march, which covered some 37 miles in less than 30 hours, he lost several hundred that way. At noon on March 23, the vanguard of Jackson's army arrived 5 miles south of Winchester, and the rest of the men soon caught up. In the military terms of that era, this was blazing, unprecedented speed. Seen from Washington, D.C., it was a virtual blink of the eye. With Ashby's fleet and highly contentious cavalry in front as a screen, moreover, the army's march north had been completely undetected. Jackson immediately moved all of his troops off the exposed Valley Pike and into the woods just to the west. The day had brightened, the clouds had burned off, and the deep chill had gone out of the air. With two of his aides, Sandy Pendleton and George Junkin, Jackson rode out to reconnoiter. What they saw was a surprise. Kimball's artillery on Pritchard's Hill looked to be several times stronger than what Ashby had led them to expect. Though this seemed odd to them, they still had no reason to challenge their fundamental assumptions. Jackson now had a choice. He could rest his hungry, aching, foot-weary men and attack the next morning. That was the sensible thing to do. Staring up at the heights of Pritchard's Hill, however, Jackson realized how visible he was. If the Federals saw his full force, they might have time to bring up reinforcements, and Jackson would lose what he believed incorrectly was his advantage. His reconnaissance had discovered something else, too. Roughly a mile to the west of Pritchard's Hill was a 4-mile-long by 3/4-mile-wide, elevated, intermittently wooded table of land the locals called Sandy Ridge. It was not only high ground, it was also higher than Pritchard's Hill, and therefore ideal for artillery placement. In spite of the weariness of his men, Jackson decided he would attack immediately. He was worried only about doing so on the Sabbath, which he rigorously kept free of all secular activity. There could be nothing more secular than killing human beings with shells and bullets. "I was greatly concerned, too," he wrote Anna later after she had told him she worried about fighting on Sunday. He had found it very distasteful to my feelings, but I felt it my duty to do it, in consideration of the ruinous effects that might result from postponing the battle. Necessity and mercy both called for battle. He would move west through the small valley, scale Sandy Ridge, turn the Federal flank, then strike the Valley Pike in the Federal rear. There was nothing exceptional about the plan. It was standard West Point flanking tactics. But Jackson had seen in an instant something that Kimball had not: the critical tactical importance of Sandy Ridge. His assumptions of enemy troop strength, of course, were still those provided by Ashby the day before. He still believed he had more men and guns than the enemy had. Back in Winchester, Shields, in pain from his shrapnel wounds, still refused to believe that he had anything to fear. At 1:30 he ordered Kimball to concentrate forces and fight the enemy on the plain. Kimball ignored him. Whatever happened to Kernstown was his problem now. He knew how well situated his troops were, suspected that the enemy was more numerous than he looked, and believed that Ashby's purpose was to draw me from the strong position I held. Determined to stay on the defensive, he could see Jackson's lead regiments under Colonel Samuel Fulkerson moving west through the woods below him. He opened fire, raining down shell, hollow iron spheres with timed fuses that exploded into fragments, and canister on the men below. Alarmed by the intensity of the fire, Jackson ordered Fulkerson to turn and try to flank the artillery on Pritchard's Hill. Fulkerson took 1,000 men to within 500 yards of the guns and was cut to pieces. Of the 84 men killed that day in his regiments, almost all died under Kimball's artillery fire. Fulkerson's men fell back from the approaches to Pritchard's Hill. It was about 2 o'clock now, and with the main body of Jackson's troops, continued hauling themselves west toward Sandy Ridge under the constant pounding of Kimball's guns. Fulkerson's ill-fated lunge had had the effect of a feint, and it was effective in screening the movements of the Confederate cannons. Jackson also had Ashby demonstrate beyond the Valley Pike, a true feint that also worked, convincing Kimball that there was still danger on the Union left, and causing him to draw off 2 regiments to deal with it. With all this happening, Jackson was pursuing his true purpose, a flank march up Sandy Ridge that would extend his line against a weaker force. In the words of John Lyle of the 4th Virginia, Jackson moved about on horseback with a pale countenance and a set jaw, furiously stripping his front almost bare of troops to hurl the bulk of his small force on the right flank of the enemy. What he really wanted to do, and what all his training as an artillerist told him to do, was to get his batteries up on top of Sandy Ridge as quickly as possible. They rolled on, unseen, while Jackson's infantry pushed forward over the marshy low ground, crossing that same no-man's land of shot and shell toward the heights of the ridge. Their bravery was heroic and commanded the admiration and respect of all who witnessed it, wrote an Ohio infantryman who was looking down on the action from Pritchard's Hill. At 3 p.m., ironically almost the exact moment the dapper and placidly confident Nathaniel Banks was boarding a train for Harper's Ferry, Jackson's batteries thundered to life atop Sandy Ridge. It was also the moment Nathan Kimball realized the severity of his mistake in failing to secure his right flank. Jackson's guns were now 100 feet or more higher than his own, which were almost exactly a mile to the east. And now they began to find the range of Union infantry and batteries, while Kimball's guns were forced into an artillerist's nightmare, shooting uphill at the enemy. Kimball's infantry were for the moment useless, motionless, flat on their bellies, and praying that the next shell fragment was not going to embed itself in their skulls. Though ranges of Civil War artillery varied, the most common gun of the war, the 12-pounder Napoleon smoothbore, could shoot 1,619 yards, or just under 1 mile. Rifled guns were accurate over larger distances. The 10-pounder Parrott had a range of 1,900 yards, 1.08 miles, and the 3-inch rifles were fairly accurate at 2,000 yards, 1.14 miles. Cannon-shooting spherical case, or shrapnel, tended to operate at 500 to 1,500 yards, while the effectiveness of anything loaded with canister was limited to about 350 yards. Jackson, in his first real fight with an independent command, was quickly learning his trade. The last time any Americans had fought a war was 15 years earlier, in a different country, with different weapons, and most of the men who were running this war had little or no experience of traditional battlefield command. Indians had generally refused to fight pitched battles, fighting mounted Cheyennes or Comanches on the open plains or Seminoles in Florida swamps required an entirely different set of skills. Civil War tactics were invented on the fly by men trying desperately to see through the sulfurous smoke and fog of battle, to understand terrain, troop movement, supply trains, the effects of artillery bombardment on infantry, and 100 other things that were not covered in West Point's dry texts or in Napoleon's maxims. Jackson had made some very good moves, some calculated, some purely reactive. He had surprised the enemy with a fast and unexpected march, so successfully cloaked that to the dumbfounded Shields, who did not learn that Jackson himself was present on the battlefield until 3:30 p.m., he had appeared as if from nowhere. Such materializations from the ether would become a Jackson hallmark. He had grasped the tactical significance of Sandy Ridge before his opponent had. He had screened the movement of his artillery, had gotten it to the high ground first, and had used his advantage in elevation to devastating effect. He had, moreover, already understood and put into practice something that both Confederate and Union armies would be relatively slow to learn. Though it was common practice in military theory to attach batteries to brigades and have them support those brigades on the battlefield, Jackson had detached and massed his artillery on the hilltop, creating far more concentrated firepower. He had, moreover, by the strength and surprise of his attack, forced Kimball, who had been led by Jackson's audacity to believe that the two sides had equal numbers of men, to play his tactical game. With his numerical advantage, all Kimball had to do to win the battle was bring a large force against Jackson's right flank. He would have turned it quickly, and would just as quickly have captured the supply trains in the Confederate rear. If he had done so, he would have won a stunning victory. He would have been a hero. Instead, befuddled by the speed of Jackson's movement and the telling effect of his big guns, he swung heavily to his right, trading finesse for brute force. But Jackson had made mistakes too, and would make more this day. As in the Romney campaign, he had told none of his subordinates anything of his battle plan. Not even Brigadier General Richard Garnett, a veteran soldier and the commander of the Stonewall Brigade, as well as his second in command. This was shocking on its face, illogic from a supremely logical man. It had already resulted in confusion over whether one of Garnett's regiments was supposed to support Fulkerson's attempt to turn Kimball's artillery. That attempt itself had been a mistake. Jackson had allowed himself to be distracted by Kimball's guns from his main goal of gaining the ridge. The effect was to slow the movement westward of his regiments, which would now be fed into the battle in fragmentary fashion. Piecemeal attack, which ceded the advantage of massed firepower, was one of the cardinal sins committed by generals in the Civil War, even the best ones. Jackson was learning about that too. But he would never learn to share information freely with subordinates. It was a glaring weakness, and it would haunt him here and throughout the war. Sometime after 3 p.m., while Jackson was winning his artillery duel with Colonel Kimball, his young aide, Sandy Pendleton, climbed to one of the highest points on Sandy Ridge for a better view of Pritchard's Hill and the countryside around it. He was astonished by what he saw. At least 10,000 Union troops, with artillery to match, positioned squarely in front of Winchester. This was not the skeleton force of four regiments Ashby had reported. This was a full division. Not only that, Pendleton counted fully five regimental flags floating down one of the roads that led to Sandy Ridge, coming directly toward him. One of Kimball's brigade commanders, Colonel Erastus B. Tyler, a fur merchant from Ohio, was moving in force against the batteries that had been antagonizing him, and therefore toward the bulk of Jackson's army, which was still shifting leftward through the wooded low ground. Pendleton galloped back to Jackson to report the news. We have no record of Jackson's expression when he heard it, but we know what he told Pendleton. "Say nothing about it," he said. "We are in for it." So Garnett and other commanders, who knew nothing about the battle plan, would know nothing about enemy troop strength either. It is safe to say that no other general, on either side, would have chosen to proceed this way. Jackson, who had been planning a general assault, abandoned that plan. He would have to shift from offense to defense. Outnumbered again, he was suddenly in a desperate battle for survival. The Battle of Kernstown, as this fight would be known, entered its second phase when Colonel Nathan Kimball, weary of the dominance of Jackson's cannons, sent Tyler's 2,300-man brigade to silence them. That was what Pendleton had seen coming at him. Tyler, deploying west along the Cedar Creek Grade Road, and then south along Sandy Ridge, ran headlong into the lead regiment of the Stonewall Brigade, the 27th Virginia, which itself was swinging west and north to defend the artillery. Badly outnumbered, these 200 men, under their intrepid commander, 6'4", 260-pound Colonel John Eccles, fell back behind a half-mile-long, shoulder-high stone wall that ran east to west and rose and fell with the broken landscape. At about 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, March 23, with only a few hours of daylight remaining, the battle, which had up to that point really been an artillery duel, became a desperate fight for control of that stone wall on Sandy Ridge. Erastus Tyler's opening gambit in this improvised war where commanding officers had to learn by trial and error was a grievous mistake. To take his men more efficiently through the wood, he had formed them in what was known in military jargon as a close or massed column by divisions. That meant that instead of long, linear, two-man-deep battle lines, the typical Civil War battlefield deployment, his men were configured in a large rectangular box that measured some 75 yards across its front and 400 yards deep. Two companies made up the front line. Behind them stretched the other 48 companies in 24 lines, set up front to back like dominoes. In that configuration, they indeed moved easily through the woods on the northern part of Sandy Ridge. The weather had dramatically improved. On the second day of the Shenandoah Spring, the sun was finally shining. "It was a beautiful day," wrote an infantryman in the 7th Ohio. "Birds sang in the trees, and the warm sun brought out all the aromatic odors of the forest." Minutes later, the exhilaration of spring was gone. Tyler's lead companies found themselves at the edge of the leafless wood, looking 150 yards across open ground to the stone wall, from which poured volley after volley of musket fire, red jets of yellow flame piercing the billowing rolls of smoke, while their rebel opponents shouted, "Bull Run," as loudly as they could. Jackson's artillery opened up with canister on the Federal left, and Union soldiers, who were not trained to fight in a box formation, immediately found themselves in serious trouble. Once the firing started, it was almost impossible, because of the noise, smoke, and confusion, to shake themselves out into conventional battle lines by companies and regiments. The domino analogy is apt. The bluecoats offered a dense and easy target for Eccles's riflemen at the wall. At the same time, they had temporarily lost the ability to use their huge numerical advantage to extend their lines. The fire was so hot that the 110th Pennsylvania fled backward through the ranks of the 29th Ohio, just behind them. Or, as an officer from the disgusted 29th saw it, they broke and scampered like sheep at the first fire. Thus did 200 Confederates, outnumbered 10-1, and aided by Tyler's tactical blunder, hold their own smartly against the oncoming brigade. Tyler's force had been virtually stopped in its tracks, but the battle was only 5 minutes old. From his position with the artillery on high ground a quarter mile in the rear, Jackson saw that he needed more soldiers, and began to feed the fight. Under his orders, Lieutenant Colonel John Patton and the 21st Virginia, 270 men strong, advanced to the stone wall, where they poured a hot fire into the Union ranks. Still, the entire fight at this point was only two regiments against five. Tyler's first unsuccessful assault had been on the eastern end of the stone wall. Now he noticed that the western end was undefended and ordered an attack there. Colonel Sam Fulkerson, bringing his 23rd and 37th Virginia regiments forward after being cannonaded for the better part of 2 hours, saw the same weakness, the same opening. What happened next was a deadly foot race. The 1st West Virginia rushed forward from the north, while the Virginia boys lunged from the south. The Confederates won by seconds. They set up quickly behind the wall, 500 of them, opening up with their smooth bores loaded with buck and ball, a bullet attached to three pieces of buckshot that combined the characteristics of a musket and a shotgun, on the West Virginians, who were only 50 yards away. At point-blank range, the effect on the bluecoats was deadly. Only 10 minutes had elapsed since Tyler's first charge. He had been repulsed twice. Now the Confederates, realizing the size of the Federal force, began to bring additional regiments to the wall. Brigadier General Richard Garnett finally arrived, after his long march across the low ground with the rest of his Stonewall Brigade, and inserted the 33rd Virginia just to the right of the 21st Virginia. It is noteworthy that he not only had no knowledge of any battle plan, also neither he nor his commander knew where the other was. By Jackson's orders, the 2nd Virginia came up too, as did the Irish Battalion, to fill another gap in the wall. The Federals, meanwhile, had managed to untangle themselves into disorganized clots of men at the edge of the woods, 150 to 200 yards from the stone wall. They paid the price for their confusion, as many of their men in the front lines were dropped by their own friendly fire. At one point, the 1st West Virginia had unloaded several volleys into the backs of the 7th Indiana and the 7th Ohio. The Federals were nonetheless able, from behind trees and rocks and declivities, to deliver a constant stream of fire. Along the wall, the Confederate soldiers who fell almost invariably did so with horrible head wounds, many of them lethal, caused by huge 59-caliber mini-balls that hummed like tuning forks in the sulfurous air and entered through the throat, mouth, eyes, forehead, and nose, blowing the men's brains out the sides and backs of their heads. Many soldiers later commented on the enormous sound of war. It was more of a giant, rolling roar than a succession of shots. By 4:30 p.m., a little more than half an hour into the fight, Jackson's 1,200 men behind the wall had created a stalemate with the large force, which was disorganized and strung out along a 400-yard front that was 50 to 500 yards from the stone wall. The fight went furiously on. There was little or no finesse here. It was a brutal, bloody, hard-nosed affair, rarely equaled in closeness of range and intensity of firing in the larger war that was to come. And no one, except the 110th Pennsylvania, was running away from it. Jackson himself told a friend 5 days later, "I do not recall ever having heard such a roar of musketry." Wrote a soldier in the 7th Indiana, "The battle was on in all of its fury. The woods were soon enveloped in smoke. The crashing of shells and shot and canister through the trees has left an impression on my mind that can never be effaced. The regiments were mixed up through and through each other, but we never ceased to get rid of our 60 rounds of cartridges as fast as we could load and shoot." Jackson had thus far done remarkably well in spite of enormous disadvantages. He had less than half the troops his enemy had on the battlefield. His men were armed with smoothbores, while all but 3 Federal regiments had far more accurate rifled muskets. He had only 3 rifled cannons against the Union's 14. And his men had held the wall. He knew he could not hope to win, but he still had 3 regiments in reserve and less than 2 hours of daylight, and the odds had gone up considerably for a drawn battle, one that would accomplish everything he had been ordered by Johnston to do, and more. "I became satisfied that we could not expect to defeat the enemy," he later wrote, "and that our safety consisted in holding our position until night and drawing off under the cover of darkness." At almost the very same moment, around 4:30 p.m., it occurred to Colonel Nathan Kimball, on his own high ridge a mile to the east, that he could lose. He had fully 3,600 men he had not used. Just as Jackson had earlier stripped his right of troops to seize Sandy Ridge, Kimball gathered up regiments on his unthreatened left and sent them double-quicking across the little meadowed valley between the two heights and into the fight at the eastern end of his battle line. Now came the final slugfest at the wall, the last hour of the fight. Most of the action had shifted east, where Kimball's fresh troops were shouldering into Jackson's bone-tired, battle-weary force. For Jackson, it was a race to darkness. The fighting at the wall, brutal and constant for a full hour, now turned desperate. A measure of its intensity was the astounding tale of the regimental flag of the 2nd Virginia Regiment. The bearers of regimental colors were often targets of the enemy, both because they stood out as easy targets and because the flags were important in telling soldiers where the rest of their regiment was and in which direction it was heading. The carnage began when the first standard-bearer, Sergeant Ephraim Crist, was shot in the head and killed instantly. Lieutenant J.B. Davis, who picked it up, was knocked out of action by a spent ball. Lieutenant Richard Lee then took up the flag and, with reckless bravery, jumped over the wall and brandished it at members of the 67th Ohio, who refused out of respect to shoot him, saying, "Don't shoot that man, he is too brave to die." They ordered him back over his wall, where he was soon wounded severely in the leg. A fourth unknown man who grabbed the flag fell mortally wounded. Finally, a full colonel, James W. Allen, leaned down from his horse, picked up the colors, and rode them to the wall where his 250 surviving troops rallied around him. By the time the colors got there, they bore the marks of 14 bullet holes, and the banner's flagstaff had been shot in two. The 5th Ohio had a similar experience. Five different standard-bearers were killed or wounded within a few minutes. Then something happened that no one, including Jackson, had counted on. At about 5:30, as the sun was setting over the battlements of the Alleghenies, and Jackson's goal of a drawn battle was in sight, the Confederate soldiers at the wall began to run out of ammunition. It began, predictably, with the courageous 27th Virginia, the men who had started the fight at the stone wall. They had carried only 40 to 60 rounds in their cartridge boxes to begin with, and whatever ammunition the Valley Army had was sitting several miles away, back on the Valley Pike. Amazingly, in spite of this, the Confederates, exhorted by Brigadier General Garnett, who stormed up and down the ranks, had managed to repulse three Ohio regiments that had assaulted the eastern wall. But the Federal numbers were beginning to tell. Fresh, well-armed Federal regiments were coming up to replace regiments that were themselves running out of bullets. And Kimball was beginning at last to use his numerical advantage to extend his line. Now, in the smoky blue twilight, came the hammer blow. Two fresh Indiana regiments, the 13th and 14th, hit the eastern part of the wall, whose defenders had virtually no ammunition left. Fearing envelopment, Garnett, at about 6 p.m., called retreat. A few minutes later, Jackson, who had ordered up reserves from the Valley Pike, was astonished to see his men streaming to the rear. He found Garnett and furiously dressed him down for ordering the withdrawal. "He did not manifest any concern," Jackson later wrote of Garnett, "and was not using any efforts to rally his men. I rode up to him and asked why he did not rally his men, or try to do so. He told me he had done so till he was hoarse." Jackson, incredulous, then rode back and forth, as bullets whickered about him, loudly exhorting the men back into battle. He could not believe what was happening. He grabbed a young drummer next to him, and with his hand on the boy's shoulder yelled, "Beat the rally! Beat the rally!" But he was too late, as were the Reserve 5th and 42nd Virginia regiments he had summoned, who arrived at about 6:30 but could do no more than help cover the retreat. The rest was messy. Men fell back in disorder. Regiments fell apart in the oncoming darkness. The army became formless. The Union cavalry, for once, showed some aggressiveness, riding around the disintegrating Confederate left flank and rounding up several hundred prisoners who were later paraded through the streets of Winchester. "We all scattered, every fellow for himself, building fires out of fence rails and making ourselves as comfortable as possible after the fatigues of the day," wrote John Kessler of the 5th Virginia. Jackson ordered the bloodied army into bivouac about 5 miles south of the battlefield. He rode silently with them, and at one point stopped by a campfire. "General," said one of the men, "looks like you cut off more tobacco today than you could chew." Jackson replied simply, "Oh, I think we did very well." He had a small dinner of bread and meat, his first food of the day, gave thanks to God, and went to sleep on a bed of fence rails, without a blanket, next to his chief commissary, Wells Hawks. The next day, Jackson's army headed south once again, pursued by the same army that had chased them less than a week before. Jackson's men, battered, parched, and exhausted, agreed with his assessment of the battle.